Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Game Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rudolf Inders, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Maxwell Foxman, one of the editors of Mainstreaming and Game Journalism. The publisher is MIT Press. Before we jump right in, though, I want to let you know that if you like our show, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or the audio platform of your very choice. You're also more than welcome to leave feedback or questions on Spotify too. Please feel also free to share this episode with your friends or wherever you see fit. And now back to the show. Mainstreaming and game journalism addresses both the history and current practice of game journalism, along with the roles writers and industry play in conveying that the medium is a mainstream form of entertainment. Through interviews and reporters, Maxwell Foxman and David B. Niebuhr retrace how the game industry and journalists started a subcultural spiral in the 1980s that continues to this very day. And speaking of today, I'm sure we can learn so much more about this topic. Maxwell, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to chat about the book on behalf of myself and my co-author, David Niebuhr.
Yes, great. Well, I wonder if you could begin our little chat by telling us a bit about yourself, and please don't hesitate and tell us what's your favorite game and the one you're playing right now.
Sure. I'm an assistant professor of media studies and game studies at the School of Journalism and Communication at the University of Oregon. I'm also directing our new game studies minor, which was approved to start in 2024, in the fall of 2024. Most of my research looks at the intersection of games and play in non-game contexts, looking at how games, for instance, interact with media professions like journalism, but also looking at esports, gamification, and even games and innovations like virtual reality and XR. So, I also am one of the co-directors of the Esports and Games Research Lab at the University of Oregon, and I'm also the chair for game studies at the International Communication Association. In terms of my favorite game of all time and what I'm playing now, one of my favorites, it's so hard to choose, that I loved as a kid and that I'm actually coming back to, is the JRPG Star Ocean Second Story, which was recently re-released. And I'm really interested to see what it's like now that I'm playing it as an adult, because I haven't looked at it in about, it must be 10 to 20 years. And I mean, I just to keep things real, probably the game that I'm playing most is Wordle. I have a couple hundred day streak going, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Well, circling back to your book then, maybe let's start. Can you provide insights into the historical trajectory of game journalism, particularly how the relationship between the game industry and journalists in the 80s influenced the current state of the industry, and of course, what key factors contributed to the subcultural spiral, and how has it continued to shape game journalism today?
Sure. So I think one of the things that it's always important for us to remember as game studies scholars is that game journalism is still how a lot of people are first exposed to games and how they're framed in the larger public eye. And in some ways, that is something that has a 40 to 50 year old history, if not longer. And so, as you said in the book, we talk about how starting in the 1980s, you have the development of what we call the enthusiast press, which was the press that was promoted particularly by the industry itself. Examples of this are magazines like Nintendo Power. And that press, which was, you know, made by the industry, literally printed by game companies, was meant to appeal to a very exclusive audience. This was coming off of, at least in the context of North America, the video game crash of the 1980s. And as a consequence, game studios were really appealing to a very exclusive audience. And that exclusive audience was young boys. And we argue that it's really the establishment of this press that creates a subcultural spiral, where it's seen as outside of really the mainstream media, or games are seen as outside of mainstream culture. So there, we argue in the book that there's this battle essentially between industry, journalists, and players about who are gamers, what are real games, and what is good gameplay. In terms of factors that contributed to this spiral, there are a couple that are really endemic. So a big one is access. Game companies obviously keep tight control over who gets access to their games, who gets access to them early, who can write reviews, previews, etc. That specific type of audience that is catered to is another important factor in terms of using language that would appeal to, at the time, young boys, and it sort of evolves into young men. There's a focus, for understandable reasons, by the industry on products, sales, and technology. So you have articles around things like console wars, which in some ways are a very exclusive thing to cover, because consoles change, but how that affects content is maybe questionable. And in terms of journalists, there's a real reliance on what we call passionate experts to tell stories, people that really love games and can play them well. And so, of course, that excludes those who maybe are new to games or don't have the same sort of gaming capital, to use the term from Mia Consalvo, to talk about games. And so the result is that we often see games treated as something subcultural today. And it looks different based on outlet, obviously. You know, the enthusiast press is still in existence today, and is obviously interested in subcultural stories, in the kind of nuances of games that are important, but maybe aren't easily understood by those who aren't really, really avid players. And then on the other side, you have the institutional press, you know, your major national outlets like the New York Times, which are interested in games, but often frame them either as in what Dimitri Williams calls as utopian or dystopian frames. We actually start off the book with a real example of this, a New Yorker article about the phenomenon in 2018 that was Fortnite, and how in the article's heading or subheading, they compare it to Beatlemania, eating Tide Pods, and the opioid epidemic, which is just this sort of perfect combination of weird dystopian frames that is interesting to read, but obviously doesn't really reflect the experience of most players.
I was just thinking utopian, the dystopian. That's what I'm talking about. You know, this is really exciting. This gets my heart racing now. I'm in the right mood. So your book then outlines three overlapping factors for the mainstreaming of games. That is broader media coverage, ludic literacy, and cultural legitimacy. Could you elaborate on how these factors interact with each other, and which do you believe has been the most challenging to achieve in the ongoing process of mainstreaming video games?
Sure. And in many ways, I think this is really the crux of the book, because as David and I started to look into the literature of of mainstream media? We were asking this question as we were developing the book and starting research for it. What we found was there really isn't a lot of literature about mainstream media per se. Often mainstream media is a term that is positioned against alternative forms of media. So we wanted to really lay some groundwork, as you're saying, about how can games be or not be mainstream? What is the process of mainstreaming? And so, as you said, we have these three criteria that we came up with, and the first is ubiquity, which is to say that we say that games require broad and easy access. And you can see this in other cultural art forms. You can think about the relative ease, for instance, for accessing music or movies. This is something that has a long history of people just having very, very easy access to. Our second criteria is literacy, where we basically argue that writers and readers need a shared understanding of the medium. And of course, in the case of games, this is ludic literacy. But just to use other media as an example, again, if you take something like film, there's a basic understanding or a basic common language that many of us use almost without thinking about it, things like close-ups or pans. And this is something that actually, if you look into the history of film criticism, that the press really played a key role in helping cultivate that language that now everyone kind of takes for granted. And the third is that games need legitimacy or a kind of cultural acceptance from both mainstream and enthusiast presses. And so to answer your question about, the most challenging to the mainstream process, in some ways, all three are challenging. I mean, to be fair, games are very, very ubiquitous. If we're talking about digital games, everyone that I know at least has a cell phone, and that phone probably has a game or two on it. But games in general, and even that cell phone, if we want to get into the nuance of it, are still pretty expensive. And certain games obviously require a lot of money to spend over time. You think about the relative high price point of a AAA game or games as services where you're expected to put in, quite a bit of money over time. I'm a fairly avid Pokemon Go player, and I don't like to imagine how much money I've actually put into the game over the last 6 or 7 years. but the other two factors I'd say are even more challenging, right? Ludic literacy is still not very common. If you go back to that New Yorker article that I mentioned, the author, Nick Palmgarten, he's a really, he writes a really wonderful article, but he starts off the article with this question. He says, "Shall I explain the game?" And what an odd question if you think about literacy. No one, if you're writing a review or even a feature about music, will say, "Shall I explain music?" If you read a film review, you don't get the comment, "Shall I explain film?" But he does make that qualification, "Shall I explain the game?" And part of this is that often that core audience that I mentioned earlier, those young avid players, often challenge the common knowledge or an attempt to common knowledge. They can be pretty vitriolic if writers aren't really really sort of showing themselves to be the absolute best players, having really detailed knowledge of a game. We talk a little bit about the apology that Dean Takahashi had to make after a really a video him playing Cuphead really, really bad. Again, you wouldn't expect a music reviewer to play music really well or badly. And then I think legitimacy is also complicated. We describe how enthusiast outlets are, doing increasingly serious work. So when I say enthusiast outlets doing serious work, there's excellent work that comes out very, fairly often from outlets like Polygon or Kotaku, but there just aren't that many outlets, right? There aren't that many enthusiast outlets or that many writers doing that type of work. And mainstream outlets really go up and down in terms of coverage. in terms of, what you might think of as legitimate coverage. In the course of writing this book, I believe the Washington Post's launcher vertical actually rose and fell. In other words, it was launched to much fanfare, and then the entire vertical was disbanded by the newspaper. And I think that's indicative of the challenges of legitimacy that we see if you have institutional outlets kind of going in and going out in terms of how much investment they make into this subject matter. So, for better or worse, I think all three of those components, when it comes to mainstreaming, really are consistently being challenged, even 50 or 60 years into the history of digital games.
Well, your book also discusses the challenges actually faced by game journalists, including marginalization and the struggle for freelance opportunities. And this is also something that I'm very aware of coming from a German perspective. How have these challenges impacted the professional landscape for game journalists? And have there been notable shifts or improvements in recent years?
Absolutely. So there have been some notable shifts, but in terms of these challenges, we do enter identify three that we think not only affect journalists, but in tandem with that, also affect their ability to mainstream games. In other words, their ability to bring games into public view as a mainstream medium. And so the three that we identify are precarity or financial insecurity of writers, specialization. Again, the writers are expected to specialize or be expert in games, and that challenges literacy, and a lack of sincerity, particularly by the institutional press. In terms of shifts that have helped, in some ways, there is again more coverage of games, perhaps than ever before. And this is something we only touch on very briefly in the book, but particularly via video, there is now really just a lot of people speaking about, writing about, and showing games. So in some ways, that's a real opportunity, and one that I think both David and I are exploring in the future. But our book does focus on the print, the print press. And in some ways, I just continue to be surprised by how things remain the same. For instance, that first feature and one that you just mentioned, the struggle of freelance opportunities and the precarity of games journalists. I actually did a report for the Tau Center for Digital Journalism about how journalists can write about and use virtual worlds, ranging from massive multiplayer online games to virtual reality in their writing. And one of the things I found was I was doing interviews for right 2020, 2021, and I found that the same issues of job precarity that David and I identified in the book, where we're doing interviews mostly through 2018, just persisted 2 to 3 years later. And I see posts about this every day that writing about games is a precarious job and often requires people to work on by constantly pitching the next story, which can have, especially in the North American context, issues in terms of healthcare, job security, and so on and so forth. I mean, to put it simply, we interviewed people who had to stop writing about games because they wanted to have a family, and this just wasn't providing them with full-time income. And I think, the one thing that might be changing in terms of the shifts in recent years that is perhaps most hopeful is how games themselves are being made and marketed. I mean, what's interesting is the service model that we're increasingly seeing in games, and you could think of something like esports or a game like League of Legends, where, it's ostensibly the same game as a platform for over a decade, actually allows for more consistent reporting. It allows for reporting on the minutia of a game. It allows for the reporting of one game consistently and to report about it from all sides in a way that perhaps is more difficult if you're writing a review of a 200-hour game and you're going to write a 500 to 1,000-word review and you have to spend all the time playing that game, often for free. So, you know, that's one thing that I think is really positive. I think another thing that has shifted in recent years that is worth highlighting is the rise of podcasts, which is an interesting shift and is one that is industry-wide. And when I say industry-wide, I mean within the journalism industry in general. There's been this very interesting rise and fall and rise of podcasts and independent podcasts. But you can see that there's places where that ecosystem is really there are some very hopeful examples, I should say, from it. You could think of the start of Remap in the wake of Vice's Waypoint Radio collapsing. And so, I mean, there are some really good stories or hopeful stories coming out about how games can be covered in the years ahead. And one other thing I should just note, which I think is important, is the book does cover North America with a real focus on the United States and Canada primarily. And so one of the other things that David and I have found, and David is speaking from his experience as a Dutch game journalist for many years, is that while some countries cover games in the manner that we're describing, others don't. We've had really interesting conversation with colleagues around certain parts of Europe and about how coverage of games looks different from country to country. And that doesn't include, obviously, other parts of the world where we also see that the coverage of games just looks different and is culturally informed by how the industry is perceived there, as well as how the press is perceived.
Yeah. I wonder, additionally, how does the ambivalence within the profession influence the broader perception of video games in the media and society? I mean, you already told us that it's one of the first touch points, so to speak, between customers or clients and the actual artifacts or cultural artifacts of digital games. But I was wondering whether this has some broader broader implications.
Yeah, I think it does. The ambivalence of game journalism is something that David and I have written about really for years. It was our first real project together, which was an article that we published for the Journal of Games Criticism, was about the deep ambivalence that game journalists feel about their own profession. And some of our earliest conversations really stemmed around how the inspiration for my side of the project, as I said, David had the experience of being a game journalist, but I was interviewing game journalists, and they often wouldn't call themselves journalists. They were hesitant to do so. They might call themselves game writers or game reviewers. And so this is something that also lies at the heart of our book. And it's something that comes from, we argue, the dependence on studios for access, and also in some ways the expectation by fans for expertise. There's few professions where you're both so dependent on an industry for how you're going to write about it, and the fans expect you to be just the very best version of what they are. And so you know, this does make journalists deeply ambivalent about their job. And, you know, if you see that along with the economic precarity that that exists within game journalism itself, without the kind of institutional investment from the press, journalists often actually do move very porously between industry and freelancing. Many of the people that I've interviewed over my seven to eight years of interviewing game journalists, many of them have gone into the industry or have gone back and forth between the industry. And it makes sense. I mean, the skills that they have about communicating about games are valuable both for readers who are reading good journalism and for the industry so they can communicate about what they're doing. But I do think this ambivalence, which sort of bears itself out, right? If one day you're a journalist and the next day you're working in communications, I mean, this obviously impacts mainstreaming because the boundaries between press, fandom, and journalism are maybe not as clear as, as David and I hope, ideally. And so it in particular, I think, makes that legitimacy category of mainstreaming difficult. If you look at sort of traditional hard news and how it exists within the web pages of mainstream sites, there are often really clear boundaries set in terms of what makes the journalism, what makes the other sections of the newspaper, the opinion section, so on and so forth. But I think that's something that really needs to be considered when we're talking about the long-term impact, because without actually drawing those clear lines consistently, it's just very difficult, I think, for fans and for the public in general to know when they're reading journalism and what that journalism is meant to convey. So we actually go as far as in the conclusion, at the very end of the book, we do try to recommend some solutions, some ways that all of us, in terms of consuming, writing, and writing about games, can mainstream games even further. And one of the solutions that we suggest is that game writers really need to lean into their journalistic orientation. If they have that ambivalence about what they are doing, they need to work hard to try not to be ambivalent, to call themselves journalists, to call their work journalism. And I think that in some ways that will be a benefit to not just them, in the sense that obviously that will demarcate their occupation, but it'll be really a benefit to the public. In fact, it's probably more beneficial to the public, because that sort of orientation allows the drawing of clear boundaries as to what these writers are doing.
Yeah, I was just only yesterday that I thought of for an article about video game essays, and yeah. It's becoming more and more clear to me that these video game essays, as a format, they represent a huge chance, because somehow they are a connection between hobbyist fan culture and classical game journalism and essayistic game journalism, and also questions that pop up in game studies not that rarely. So this may be something I will look into in the future. But this is not about me. We have some time left, so please tell us, tell our listeners, what are you working on right now?
Sure. Well, I'm working on all sorts of things, especially, like I said, I study a sort of wide variety of subjects. So I certainly am doing some work with esports, collegiate esports. I do a fair amount of work looking at game engines like Unity, which, of course, from a game journalism point of view, has had some interesting ups and downs over the last few months, and continue to do some work on immersive media and VR. But in terms of game journalism specifically, I have a few projects that I'm working on. The first, I've been working for a few years now with a colleague at the University of Houston Clear Lake, Brandon Harris, about Twitch, and specifically about Twitch's journalistic potential. So we've been looking at not only different types of journalism that are appearing on that platform, which is in some ways harkens back to some very classic types of broadcast. You can think of C-SPAN in the United States, but in other ways is obviously very, very different. And we see that really in the rise of the political commentator class that's happening on the platform. You have very interesting broadcasters on both the far right and the far left, as well as not so far right and not so far left, that are broadcasting on that platform and using it as a political commentary tool, as well as a tool for political action. So Brandon has was the first author of an article we published in Social Media and Society about Hassan Piker and how he has used Twitch as a political platform. And we have some other articles under review. And in terms of game journalism and the work that I'm doing with David, we are in the process of putting together our next project on this, to kind of continue the work that we started here, and that is most likely going to take the form of a special issue that we're putting together. So especially if there are listeners that are interested in potentially contributing on this subject matter and are in the academic world, please feel free to reach out to me. You can find all my information at the University of Oregon webpage. So
consider me interested. Consider me interested.
Absolutely. I will definitely remain in touch about that.
So thank you very much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Maxwell, take care and goodbye. So, dear listeners, I hope you like this episode. If you are an author and or an editor in the field of digital game studies yourself and want to talk about your latest publication, please do not hesitate to contact me under rudolf.indast@googlemail.com. Alternatively, please send me a direct message on social media. You will find me under Rudolf Indast on Facebook and Instagram and under @GameStudies on Blue Sky. And again, please share this episode where you see fit and always keep playful.